English Day. War on Damascus this week. Assassination pretext technicians Amy Goodman and Glenn Greenwald insult our intelligence that the stupidest enemy ever just gave U.S. a pretext when it won the war with U.S., U.K., Israeli soldiers caught in Eastern Ghouta chemical weapons in hand from the journalist giving hoes a bad name. Shelby's story on NSA assassinations now spewing today's big lie. Yesterday on March Finale, the evidence is quite overwhelming that the perpetrators of this chemical weapons attack, as well as the previous one, is the Assad government. Nothing here, folks. Move along.
DA's office. Look.
Preach. That was last week's show. This is researcher. Oh, that's Jesse Jackson. I gotta stick with turn down the mic. Okay. So, the impending attack on Damascus by the U.S. was partially due to what the SSA might uncover in Eastern Ghouta, and because they were able to move fast, they overran the U.S. coalition's chemical weapons operations faster than anyone thought possible. Our pleading with Syria has been rewarded with these new photos. The SSA has U.S. coalition chemical weapon officers in custody, and Russia has told the U.S., Brits, Israelis, and Saudis they will have to deal with Damascus. How long can U.S. media and our own Congress pretend they know nothing about who some of the major terrorist elements are that most afraid to mention? Their house of cards is crumbling, and they will be more dangerous in that situation. So we are talking about some serious crimes here. We are suspicious of why the Brits would throw together what appears to us to have been a sloppy false flag, even used against Russia for putting Russia's feet in the fire to get the Brit people back from Syria and keep this story out of the major news distribution. It is now time for some are they really guilty? You have to pay the piper. Oh, well, let me go to, okay. So, any military operation against Iran will likely be very unpopular around the world. Now I'm quoting from Trump's Syria withdrawal was textbook. Anyway, it was just a thing because then of course he's gonna get pushed the other way. And they're planning all this in this paperwork. For Syria, the offer was U.S. withdrawal in Damascus and its neighbor, given the responsibility humanely and the conflict. The rejection inviting the U.S. to intervene is the staged chemical attacks in Douma the U.S. is now citing. And I guess the best response would come from Syrian girl here.
And this is Syrian girl. Syria has been attacked by the U.S.-Israeli-French alliance. Missiles struck the T-4 military base, a base that is crucial to the fight against ISIS. This comes right after a false flag chemical attack in the suburb of Douma in Ghouta, Damascus. The neocons are blaming the Syrian government for the chemical attack, but once again, there is no motive because Assad was winning. After 7 years of war, Ghouta is almost completely liberated from Al-Qaeda-linked rebels. Thousands of civilians have evacuated the city. For years, the rebels weren't allowing them to leave because they were using them as human shields. Most rebel groups in Ghouta surrendered, but one rebel group called the Army of Islam, which controls Douma, refused. This is because they believed they had leverage in the form of civilian hostages that they kidnapped from a nearby pro-Assad Alawite town called Adra.
They were taken by Sunni rebels last August.
تم أسر هذه النساء والأطفال والآن كما ترون أنتم أمنين ونحن مكان جيد.
The Army of Islam, one of the groups the US listed as moderate, kidnapped men, women and children. They put them in cages and paraded them around the city of Douma, saying that if Assad bombs the rebels, the hostages would die. They were literally using them as human shields. A few weeks ago, they released footage of these hostages walking through an underground tunnel in Douma, injured and distressed. Since these civilians were from a pro-Assad Alawite town, the rebels thought that they had more value as human shields than the civilians of Douma. But the war continued, and it looked like the Army of Islam were about to surrender. But suddenly, they stalled negotiations and rained hundreds of missiles down on Damascus city center. You see, some of their members didn't want to surrender. This was when the false flag chemical attack happened. It's obvious the people, the children, that were killed in the gas attack were the hostages that the rebels had kidnapped. Footage of four children suffocated in an underground bunker emerged. A wood-burning oven right behind them was producing carbon monoxide. The rebels also released footage of perfectly healthy kids being drugged and hosed down. Some of the hostages have been rescued. Among them is Judy. She was abducted 4 years ago when she was only 8 months old. How many children just like her didn't make it and were gassed by the rebels in a false flag attack? And just look at the timing. A week prior to this attack, Trump said he would pull troops out of Syria. Now he's saying he's going to attack Assad. It's the exact repeat of last year's scenario. The chemical attack that occurred in Idlib on the 4th of April in 2017 occurred almost a year to the day of this attack. And a week prior to that attack, the US said regime change was no longer the objective in Syria. And afterwards, Trump attacked Syria. Also, a day prior to the chemical attack, Israeli President Netanyahu called Trump and told him that he wasn't allowed to pull out of Syria. It's obvious who benefits. It's not the US soldiers that recently died in North Syria. This chemical attack is the excuse that Israel and the neocons need to keep the US troops in Syria indefinitely and have a casus belli for World War III.
These 70 witnesses, all of the evidence that had never before been allowed to be seen or heard by a jury, and it took the jury 59 minutes. 59 minutes they came back and found the government agents of the United States, State of Tennessee, City of Memphis, were responsible for that crime. And there were no media present. They all left. Court TV was going to cover it. Somehow they didn't. They all left. There was no coverage of the trial, as there's been virtually no review of any of the books I've written on the case. Carl Bernstein said, don't be surprised about this. Back in 78, he did a Rolling Stone piece which indicated that the publishing might of the Central Intelligence Agency will make sure that these cases are not brought forward. They are not heard. So that is the reality. On the media side, it's not just mainstream media, it's progressive media as well. Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, people like Noam Chomsky will not deal with these political assassinations. Neither will they deal, of course, with 9/11 to the extent that they should deal with them. They just simply don't. And why is that? Well, funding comes from the Ford Foundation, which has been a CIA channel for a very long time, or Bill Moyers' entity. And there's a line that they don't cross, and they won't cross. I've come to believe these are not bad people, because a lot of the stuff they put out there is stuff American people should know about, and it's good, and it's useful. And Chomsky's analyses are very helpful and enlightening in certain areas of the world. But when it comes to certain lines, certain areas, they will not go there.
William Pepper, keep on struggling. You know you're following the teachings and the vision and the dream of Dr. King. William Pepper wrote a book about the trial and everything. An act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King. An act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King.
And that was the music of Vic Sado, the Truth Troubadour, who is here in Berkeley, California, where we broadcast the Project Censored show every week. Vic Sado, and that was his song called An Act of State based on the same title of William Pepper's book about Martin Luther King's assassination. And, of course, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with special guest co-host Ken Burroughs, San Francisco State University. And we're talking with the author, William Pepper, about his most recent book on the King assassination, The Plot to Kill King. We continue our conversation with William Pepper now.
Bill, how is it that the King family came to work with you in a decade-long effort to really find the real killers of Dr. King, and what led up to the trial that happened in 1999?
The King family was familiar with my work going back before the first book, Orders to Kill. Orders to Kill was published in 1995. They knew that I was quietly gathering evidence and working on the case. I did not involve them, did not brief them, did not try to bring them in. Martin's nephew, Isaac Farris, read Orders to Kill, and he reached out to me and asked me to meet with the family. And I did that in, I guess, 1996. They were moved by what we learned at that point in time, which, remember, is many years ago. But what we learned at that point in time moved them. And so they wanted to pursue it. And they supported a trial for James Earl Ray, which, of course, was not going to happen. And they tried to get Bill Clinton to agree to conduct an investigation. He appointed Janet Reno, his attorney general, to be in charge of that investigation. And it really just, of course, turned out to be a complete whitewash. With this kind of frustration, I suggested that maybe what we should do is actually file a civil action against one of the people whom we knew and who had admitted being involved, Lloyd Jowers. They agreed. We filed a civil action in Memphis, and the trial went on for 30 days.
And this is the civil trial. This is the King v. Jowers in 1999.
Yes, that's right. King v. Jowers civil trial. Went on for 30 days. With some 70 witnesses, was not covered by the media. The media just stayed away. The court TV at first was, oh, yes, this is something we have to cover. Well, they were told not to think about it. So because of the degree of media control in matters of this sort, very few people know that trial took place. But it did, and it took a jury 59 minutes to find that James Earl Ray had knowing involvement in the killing. And agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis did. And so that was the result of the civil trial. And the King family believed when that happened that we had closure and they had closure. And I was very pleased about that. But of course, between 1999 and 2016, when the final book, The Plot to Kill King, was released, we acquired an enormous amount of additional evidence and information about the assassination, how it took place, how King was actually killed, which is very important. And that, as far as I'm concerned now, is closure. Coretta has died, but three of the children are alive. Yolanda also died, but three of the children are alive.
Bill, can you speak to more how a King actually died versus the way we've been told he died in the media?
He was shot from the bushes in the back of the rooming house by a Memphis Police Department sharpshooter. He was hit in the face and went down and lost consciousness. He was, however, alive. He was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital. He was in the emergency room. They were working on him in the emergency room. The chief of neurosurgery, the head neurosurgeon, a doctor named Breen Bland, B-L-A-N-D, who was also the family doctor for the Dixie Mafia family, the Adkins family, came in with two men in suits and told the people, stop working on that nigger, get out and just let him die.
And that's a quote that you got during deposition?
That's an actual quote, yeah.
And that's in the book. That's actually in one of the appendices in The Plot to Kill King. You have the transcript of that.
Yeah. What I have insisted on doing is I insisted on putting in the complete text of all of the relevant transcripts, depositions, all of them, so that I can't be accused of taking things out of context or making them up. The actual depositions, the statements sworn under oath are there. So Bland said to this emergency room group that were working on King to get out of there. Stop working. That was the quote. Stop.
Him at all, and Jesse Jackson is there waiting for him. He does not look at him at all. He just more or less, he doesn't push him away, but sits down. And there's footage the same day, earlier the same day, where they arrive to the Lorraine Motel. Jesse Jackson gets out of the car. Look at his face. It is a very, very angry, brutal face on Jesse Jackson, not this sweet smile looking like Will Smith that we're used to. He looks very angry and you know, there's a very distinct look to his face. And if it's true that he at that point knew what was going to go down, that would explain the whole thing. And it's also said that he knew that that King was just about to pull his cover and expose him, and that he contacted the guys behind the plot and said, we need to act now before it's too late. This would also say, if you look at, there's another famous photo where Jesse Jackson is standing next to Martin King on the balcony. There are three of them, I think it's Albanethy as well. And Jesse Jackson is smiling. Martin Luther King is not, his face is not smiling at all. And I would say that there is a possibility that that is a stage photo, you know, that that was used then to follow up the whole thing after the assassination, that they were so close, that they were, and this is why Jesse should take over. Because the people that killed King knew that somebody would take over that position. And so to control that person, to infiltrate and control the person that would take over, would be totally in line with their plans. So when you look at that photo again with a smiling face, look at King's face, totally different. This is not like two friends standing there having a good time. And also, who took these photos? Is it this live photographer that was in the room afterwards taking photos, or who took these photos? I would very much like if anyone knows, because to be there exactly when this happened and in position and so on, if so, are there possibly photos before the shooting, during the shooting and so on? How did he get out there at exact that time and so on? So, but it seems like Dr. King did not die on the balcony, according to William Pepper and other sources. That now we get into some horrific stuff here, because when you plan and carry out these assassinations on that level, you need to cover all possibilities. You need all options covered so that the victim will not survive. This means also controlling the hospital. The
guy in the picture appearing to render aid is merely checking, and he was indeed still alive. It hadn't hit the carotid artery, or it would have been blood everywhere. And so that's why they had to take him to St. Joseph's. And he's surrounded by, even Andy Young, who was one of the possible targets, is pointing upward when the shooter, Frank Strauser, is down in the bushes that were then cut to hide the fact that he's surrounded by FBI killers, Jesse Jackson and Billy Kyle. And I thought it had the queued up to the part where Ole Damegaard is talking about their ties, because they were arguing about the fact that he refused to wear a tie to this big event they were going to at Billy Kyle's. So he's got the timing covered by Billy Kyle's being the FBI, the other guy that got the bags of FBI cash. And neither of them have ties, so the shooters are instructed, only shoot someone with a tie, and then our guys won't get accidentally whacked.
the body of Dr. King, saw Dr. Bland pull out the catheter and take a pillow and put the pillow over his face and suffocate him. Now, he might have died anyway from his wounds. It was a severe wound. But nevertheless, he was still alive. And they were not going to take any chances that he might survive.
And William Pepper, now, just to be clear, this was information presented in the trial to the jury.
No.
Right.
No,
okay. No. So that's what I'm trying to get at here. So
yes,
I just wanted to clarify that. People are still not aware of this 1999 trial.
I know.
Number one. And the media did a splendid job of ignoring it and covering it up.
Why is that the case, Bill? Why do you think the media, including progressive media, has just failed to cover this? Can you speak to that issue?
Well, of course, the corporate media refuses because the corporate media is controlled basically by the ruling moneyed forces of the society who want to keep the people calm, who don't want them to be anxious, who don't want them to lose confidence in their government, don't want them in any way to question the credibility of the agencies of government who are paid so much money in their budgets every year. So that's true with respect to the corporate media. They've really pretty much now buttoned down control of the corporate media on cases of this sort. When it comes to progressive media, they also have had ways of compromising progressive media. And so it's a great disappointment that a lot of our progressive media people simply will not deal with this, will not deal with this kind of case or this kind of issue. Now, why is that? Well, progressive media entities often are recipients of grants and awards from entities like the Ford Foundation, and that's CIA money for the most part. So they're not going to risk losing that. They don't want to cover this, and they don't cover it. Let's face it. It's only chaps like you.
Certainly at Project Censored, we have a deep interest in this. My co-host and associate, Dr. Peter Phillips, actually teaches a course that uses your active state book in it, in a sociology of conspiracy class that looks at historical conspiracy fact and looks how it challenges dominant narratives. So you're certainly on the right program as far as that issue goes. But William Pepper, given that this didn't come out in the trial, could you explain to the listeners how you got this information and how you got this deposition and why you included it in the book?
After the trial, just as after an HBO Thames television mock trial back in 92, people started to become more aware of what was going on, and some people who had vital information were approaching the grave and wanted to share it. So people came forward. One of the people who came forward was the son of the surgical nurse. His name was Jonathan Shelby. And Jonathan went into deposition with us and laid out everything the mother told them the next morning when she came home. She gathered them in the parlor and she said, "I still don't understand why they had to kill him." And then she explained what she saw and what she heard in the emergency room. So Jonathan talked about that in detail. Then the son of the Dixie Mafia leader, Adkins, who had sat in on so many meetings with his father and who knew Tolson very well and talked about Tolson's coming in continually, he came forward and agreed to go under oath. And over many hours, I think upwards of 11 hours, I deposed Ron Tyler Adkins and gave him all the opportunity that he needed to tell everything that he knew. So that we started to get this information. We started to get it well after 1999. You know, we got it into 2010, 11, 12, 13.
And so this is the reason for this other book, then. This is after Act of State, because you uncovered some of this. You had revealed some of these things in the Act of State book, but then you discovered so much more since.
Yes, that's right. This was the final book, and for me, it's the end of the story. There is really nothing more that I can do or say or expect to learn. You know, I've been on this for about 40 years, and that's what it's taken to slowly get to the bottom of what really happened to Dr. King.
And in your mind, what's the difference between the 99 jury verdict and your conclusions in the plot to kill King?
They're the same. I mean, in the sense that the jury found that agents of the government, three governments, federal, state, and local, were responsible for the killing of Martin King. And as we worked on this, we got more definitive information, more specific information, so we were able to name the people. We were able to name the people who were involved in the actual killing.
Can you name them here?
Sure. I had lunch with the shooter. His name is Frank Strauser. He's still alive. He was the one who pulled the trigger that hit Martin and knocked him down. So Strauser was the shooter. His spotter was another Memphis police officer called Earl Clark. Frank Holloman, who was the head of police and fire in Memphis and who had worked for a number of years in Hoover's office in Washington, basically it's emerged that he was the real on-the-ground coordinator after Russell Adkins died. It was Holloman who actually organized things on the ground. Frank Liberto, a mafioso, who worked with the Memphis Police Department, organized the shooting. I couldn't name Strauser for a number of years because the man who gave me his information was a janitor at the police firing range in Memphis, and he observed Strauser preparing the entire day, firing a specially delivered rifle, and then leaving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Gave us a lot of detailed information, but I couldn't reveal it because I was afraid they would kill him. So I had to hold on to that segment of information for a number of years. Lenny Curtis was his name, brave man. And we just waited. Finally, Lenny died, and we were able to use his deposition. We had a filmed and a transcribed deposition. So that was very important in terms of nailing the shooter, although the shooter didn't kill him. And the killing was by this Dr. Bland, and Ron Tyler, the Adkins boy, was present when Bland said to his father, if he's not killed with the shot, be sure he gets to my hospital so we can make sure that he doesn't leave there alive. That's how we built up this information in later years.
Thank you. It's very clear, Bill. And thank you for your good work all these years, just to acknowledge that.
One man come here to justify.